Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace. To nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist. Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius. Live. Fit. Go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at BestWestern.com.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the How to Hunt Turkey podcast. With me today, I've got Zach Vakurvich. He is with Whetstone Habitat. He does all kinds of habitat management. Super good guy. Got a really nice buck on his wall if you're watching the video podcast. Anyway, Zach, thanks for being on.
I appreciate you for having me, Jace. Thank you. I'm excited to talk turkeys.
Yeah, me too, man. And habitat, that's such an important part of it. And I think that especially with turkey, it's really hard to find good info on what good habitat even is sometimes. I mean, if you seek it out, you can find stuff, but it's not like with deer hunting where sometimes, like, whether you want to know it or not, the info is just there, right? So how did you get started into doing habitat management stuff, and what all do you do in that?
So I got a degree in wildlife and fisheries management from West Virginia University, and I always kind of knew I wanted to do something outside in natural resources. I come from a long lineage of pharmacists and healthcare professionals, so I kind of went a different route with my life. And you know, when I first got into the program, like anyone else getting into those programs, your brain is kind of like game warden. It's like the only natural resource job anyone's real familiar with.
Yeah. But
I quickly learned while I was in school that I'm glad there's game wardens out there. I love shaking their hand. Every time I see one, it's like I like introducing myself and building those relationships. But that's not what I want to do with my life. I quickly fell in love with the habitat side of things. I had a really great mentor for my internship while I was still in school with the West Virginia DNR. He kind of opened the doors and gave me free rein of a portion of the wildlife management area I was working on. So all summer long, I was an intern. I'm an intern on this WMA. And he said, okay, this section, whatever you want to do, we can get it done this summer. Plant whatever you want, whatever time of timber stand improvements you can do. We did an edge feather project, cutback border. We did a lot. And I remember coming back to that part of the wildlife management area at the end of the summer, you know, 2 months after I'd done all the chainsaw work, planting my food plots or whatever. And we saw a bunch of turkey poults flushed out of there. And all the butterflies were surrounding all the wildflowers that were, it used to be a hard, you know, woodlot, like right on the edge of the field. It was just mature timber, southern West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a cutback border, a lot of stump sprouts, a lot of, you know, vascular plants starting to pop up, very different habitat type from the surrounding area. In the amount of, you know, the bug life, the turkey poults flushed out of there, surely the fawns and the does are in there. It just clicked. It was like, oh, this is what it's all about. This is the ticket right here.
Yeah.
It's all about disturbance. And I loved kind of the blending of art and science when it comes to land management. So when I started my company, Whetstone Habitat, this will be going on 5 years this year, I really wanted to bring that to the forefront. I don't just want to help landowners in yes, of course, I want to get them to shoot bigger deer or have more turkey on their property. But what I really pride myself in is the educational side of things. That's what gets my blood pumping. So when I see that light bulb turn on, we were talking before the show starts about like showing up on a property. You said something along the lines, oh, it must be easy being able to pick out, you know, what the shortcomings are, what you need to fix.
Yeah.
And yeah, every property is a little different, but at the end of the day, you're right. There's certain attributes that different species need in order for their life cycle to carry on in a sustainable way.
Yeah.
So the land management side of things, man, it's so much fun. I get to tell other people how to invest their time and money and resources into promoting a better landscape. And in they hire me to come help manage for deer, turkey, quail, grouse, whatever. But as soon as I start getting those follow-up phone calls and they tell me about their wife noticing all the butterflies around or the new songbirds that started showing up. It's kind of where their kids playing with the frogs that are near the new pond that just went in. It's all those little things that kind of that bring me fulfillment in getting people engaged in the outdoors. And I really do. I look at myself as an educator and helping other people get their own. I like teaching people, making capable land stewards at the end of the day. They can carry that information and help their neighbors out.
Yeah, man. I love that. And I think you hit on something that I think is a really important distinction. You were talking about, it's all about disturbance. And you were talking about how you'd see the butterflies and you'd see the turkey poults and you'd have the does and fawns. I think a lot of times it's really easy to think about habitat management as a one issue thing to work on. Like, oh, I want more deer. Let's get more deer. But I think that it's really easy to forget that you've got to work big picture kind of, right? Like when you're watching like National Geographic and they've got out in the ocean, you've got all these little fish being rounded up by the big fish and the birds diving from above and the giant yellowfin mm-hmm. tuna below. Like that's like a species level, just like an incredible wealth of resource, right? And I think to make a rich deer hunting property or turkey hunting property, according to what you're saying here, you got to make a rich property, period. And then that other stuff sort of comes later. Is that about how it is?
Yeah, couldn't have said it better myself. I think so often people fall into these traps, especially with which I'm sure it'll come up eventually with food plots. Mm. You know, what can we put in the ground that's going to grow big, huge, giant buck or bring all the turkeys onto my property this, that, mm-hmm. or the other? And it's so narrow-minded. Like, if you start digging into the research and you're looking at, okay, I read a study one time that was talking about what doe with fawns is consuming in the middle of summer in, you know, Iowa agriculture, where 90% of the landscape is soybeans, a very, very, very highly preferred deer forage.
Yeah.
Out there in the landscape. Okay. So that's pretty much the only thing occupying most of the space. 10% mm-hmm. of the ground is probably bush honeysuckle, multiflora rose, not very good invasive species down in the ditches. You know, there's some areas, marginal grounds. That's about all the habitat that these deer are working with.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at what those deer are eating in the middle of summertime, when those beans are the most attractive and nutritious, and you would expect that doe is going to be eating nothing but soybeans, right?
Yeah.
Even still, if you go and harvest that doe in the summertime and do a study on her and open up her stomach contents, the soybeans might only make up 60%. The rest of it's going to be woody browse. It's going to be ragweed. It's going to be goldenrod. It's going to mm-hmm. be all of this stuff growing all over, because they're selective grazers all yep. day long. When they're getting up from being bedded down, they're nibbling on this, that, and the other. They're moving around. They have a very diverse diet type. Same thing with turkeys. When you cut open a turkey's crop, it might be full of just wheat seed heads, but the next day you shoot a turkey and cut it open, it'll be 10 different things, because that turkey came from the neighbor's property where they're eating earthworms and clover, and, you know, like, so when you're talking about maintaining these systems and taking care of these animals, I'm very much in the mindset, let's take care of the whole system. It's a landscape approach.
Yeah.
So with regards to turkeys, we're managing turkeys. People want to talk about food plots because that's what's been ingrained in us over the years mm-hmm. in the deer hunting world.
Yeah.
That's not where you start with turkeys. If you're a landowner and you're concerned about turkeys and you're seeing a decrease in turkey population, food plots aren't going to fix that problem. Right. You could have all the food in the world for those turkey. You're not going to have more turkeys utilizing that location because you're not helping with the recruitment rates. Now, a recruitment rate is how many turkey poults hatch and make it through to that first season. Okay. How yeah. many turkey poults make it from an egg till they're independent and viable, breeding age, one year old. Well, if your turkey recruitment is zero, you're going to run out of time. You're going to run out of turkeys fast.
Yeah.
So when you're talking turkey management and habitat, always start with nesting cover and brooding locations for those birds. Hmm. Because until you take care of that recruitment, there's a saying out there, never fall in love with a ground nesting bird.
Yeah.
It's so true. So much can go wrong. There is so yeah. much that can go wrong. Everything loves to eat turkeys, whether you're an owl, whether you're a hawk, whether you're a raccoon, everything wants to get their mouth on a turkey.
Absolutely.
So the more habitat work we can do, the harder we can make it for those predators to find those nests or those turkey poults. That's how you start building your turkey population. The food plots come next. We can talk about food plots all we want down the road, but until you have a sustainable population of birds to hunt, like, you need to start there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So kind of a long-winded way of saying it's everything. It's all encompassing. Everything relies on each other. Your old forest is important for, you know, your acorn production. You're going to have the most acorns coming off those mature white oak trees. That's where your turkeys are going to roost, is going to be in those big mature trees. But guess what? They're going to be putting their nest in the part you just cut over with treetops laying down, and you can't hardly walk through it. They need different habitat types. You might wonder where you got all the turkeys in the world during the fall, but during spring season, you don't got any turkeys on your farm. It's because you're missing whatever habitat type that your neighbor has it. You don't.
Yeah.
They're taking advantage of it somewhere else. So
yeah.
So yeah, you have to look at it as a landscape approach. And too many people get narrow-minded and dig into those food plots. And trust me, I love food plots. I recommend them on every property I work on. But, you know, on the hierarchy of things that I'm concerned about, what's going in those food plots is way at the bottom.
Yeah. Well, because if you could just slap a food plot in and shoot whatever buck you wanted or whatever turkey you wanted, no one would ever have questions, right? If a food plot really fixed the problem, nobody would need to watch a podcast on how to hunt turkeys because it would just, you put in the food plot and work. For an example of that, when you were talking about it, I was thinking about this. My neighbor a couple years ago had several hundred acres of wheat. Mm-hmm. And one time in all of turkey season did I see a turkey in that wheat field. Once.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you hear about those things and you're like, oh yeah, he's planted it in wheat and that's going to be great. And I thought it would be great for deer. And it really wasn't, because like you said, they're out there working on something else that they know they need. Because I think that deer and turkeys understand food differently than we do, right? Like, we could go eat a burger and fries every day for a month and be blissfully ignorant of how that's slowly killing us. But for a deer and a turkey, they have to be more selective, right? Because they have to get the right sort of nutrients. So yeah, it's definitely not all in the food plot, but you've answered my next question already, which is, what's the biggest problem that you see? And so you were saying that's lack of nesting and brood rearing habitat, right? So
yeah.
I'm going to give you a hypothetical here. So imagine, if you will, you've got this farm in southwest Missouri. It's got a couple of hills on it, and it's got a few patches of very young woods, like 40 to 60 years old. Like, there's not a mature tree in it. Mm-hmm. And the understory is multiflora rows pretty well exclusively. There's no midstory, and you got some oak trees of red and white oaks, and that's about it. What's the first thing you're doing in a situation like that for turkeys?
So the first thing I would be doing is the area you described in my mind as I'm walking through that woodlot, and I've been through so many woodlots covered in multiflora rows, medium aged. It's actually pretty good nesting cover. If it's what I have in my mind, turkeys won't hesitate to nest in that stuff.
Okay.
The problem you run into is once those birds hatch, they immediately need to get to an area where, what's a turkey poult eating? Let's start there, okay? Mm. So versus mom's out there, she's in the clover plot, she's eating clover, she's eating wheat seed heads. There might be a few red oak acorns late in the spring that she found that didn't rot yet, whatever. But those turkey poults are out there, they're eating almost exclusively bugs, okay? Insects, protein. So the areas you're going to find the most amount of insect life are going to be the areas that you have species that are pollinators. So early successional habitats, right? What I would do with a situation like that is eventually, yes, it would be great to get rid of all of that multiflora rows. That should be the end goal. Is eventually you would like to see, you know, blackberries, raspberries, or native brambles start to take over and occupy those spaces in that niche. Until you address the multiflora rows, that is not going to happen. But what I would do to take a property like that, where you got, like, what you say, three different woodlots that are about similar structure in all of them.
Yep.
I would start with the woodlots and go one at a time addressing them. I would leave two of them for nesting cover the first year. I would address the multiflora rows, get that out, go in. I would thin the canopy. I would pick your most, you know, pick your oak trees and do a crop tree release or whatever you want. Maybe you got some walnuts in there that are fairly straight. You want to protect those. Pick whatever trees you as a land manager. That's the fun part as a land manager. That's your call. Pick which trees you want. Get rid of the surrounding vegetation, but only open that canopy up after you've addressed the multiflora rows. That's one of the biggest mistakes I see, is where people get ahead of themselves and they'll, oh, I need to put a bedding thicket in, and they'll go in and they'll open it up, but they weren't paying attention. They didn't notice the multiflora rose or the bush honeysuckle or the Japanese stilt grass. And next thing you know, it just explodes. Mm. So I would address it one area at a time. I would start on one section, address those invasives. I would thin that woodlot out and then follow up either this winter with a prescribed burn or next spring and get some fire on the ground.
Gotcha.
And then I'll rotate to the next one. In the next year, I'd start on that one. And then the following year, rotate to the next one. Now, here's where you get into the distinction. So there is a distinction between nesting cover and brooding cover. Okay. Nesting cover, like, let's think of an old field, for example. You burn that field, you get a nice, good, hot burn in that field. It's bare dirt in the wintertime. It springs up. There's turkeys displaying out there. They're not going to nest out in that area. They might bring their poults out there because there's going to be bare exposed ground. That's great poulting cover because they got bare ground that those poults can navigate in and around those clumps of grass that are starting to sprout back and stuff. If you go back to that same field the next year or the next year, so 2 years post-burn or 3 years post-burn or 4 years post-burn, once you start getting those brambles, once that site has more time to respond, where you get some woody component going in, your shrubs, your dogwoods, you know, your box elder, some of the smaller trees start establishing, that's your nesting cover. When you have more of that horizontal vertical structure, more thick, more dense, you can, if you're going with a straight field and you're doing nothing but a burn rotation, you know, that's where you can start getting into it, where you say, okay, the first 2 years are great bugging cover. The second 2 years are great nesting cover. Maybe it's a 4 year fire return interval with two different sections that I burn, okay. You know, and you offset them. So you never want to address everything. If you can kill all that multi-floor rows all at the same time, by all means, go for it. Mm-hmm. I always try to keep people in realistic situations so they don't feel defeated when they get out there. I mean, I've worked on properties where it's just like, it feels like you're not getting anywhere with the invasives, but I promise you it's worth it. It's like, it's one of the hardest things I do on a regular basis is trying to get these landowners to care about these non-native plants that are taking over. And until I can get them have you ever seen a deer eating Johnson grass? No, they're not going to, you know, like let's open up these spaces. Cause what people don't understand is the reason non-natives become such an issue is because there's no natural predators here. That's one aspect of it. Okay. So you get something like Sericea lespidisa. Yeah. Deer will browse on it every now and then, but it's not a highly preferred food, no natural predator. And then what happens is you have these plants like Johnson grass, it'll green up before any of our native warm season grasses.
Yeah.
It'll stay green later. Then all the same thing with like multiflora rose. Multiflora rose is green way before blackberry and it stays green way later than those blackberry bushes.
Oh yeah.
So the growing window is way longer. There's no room for our native brambles to establish because everything's occupied too early in the year.
Mm-hmm.
So getting people to care about those kind of things is huge. Again, we're going back to the whole holistic approach and trying to take care of things and undo, what does Kabbalah always say? Unburdened by what has been. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to unburden these landscapes from poor management in the past.
Yeah, I definitely.
Doing nothing oftentimes worse than nothing. You know, it's worse than doing something wrong.
I believe it. So when you're going in to get rid of multiflora rose, how do you do that? What's the best way to kill it where it won't return?
Foliar spray is a good one where you can spot treat it, especially if it's in really dense patches. There's not a lot of collateral you got to worry about as far as killing other species. I would just do a backpack sprayer.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways that I've found to be pretty quick as far as like treating those big patches. So for people listening, multiflora rose is, it's hell to treat. If you've never dealt with it, it's long. It's like a blackberry bush, just thorns everywhere. They kind of sprawl out weeping over the ground. So if you're going to do a cut stump method, which is probably preferred to make sure it's dead, it's just the hardest to do. You have to cut each one of those individual stems at the base of that thing and treat the stump.
Mm.
One of the things I've found for covering the most amount of ground is if you can get a backpack sprayer on that you can clip that wand onto and then run a tri-blade weed with your hands.
Yeah.
So you can cut through it and flip the vegetation out of the way. And then grab your sprayer and treat the stump like that. That's the fastest method.
Habitat management assassin right there.
Yeah. They used to call me the angel of death at my old job.
Yeah, man.
Pretty much exclusively coming up with ways to kill invasives.
Yeah, well, like you said, it's all about disruption, right? You got to get some sunlight to some new places and get away from that monoculture mindset. I think that just in everything, we've become really monocultural, like with our plants. You want to plant a field of this and you want to get 1,000,000% of that and nothing else. Like for instance, in my garden this year, We had the idea to plant some flowers to help attract bees and pollinators and all of those things as well.
Right.
And I walk out there and it's just like so cool to get to see that. And that's one minor change. And meanwhile, I am trying to kill every other species of plant there, but that's a different deal, right?
Yeah.
It's a garden. But it's so fun to be around actual diverse habitat when you get a chance to do it. You get a chance to look at something like that and it changes how you think about it, I think.
Well, in people, my clients, they give me a hard time all the time. I love grasslands. I'm absolutely obsessed with grasslands. I'm all about prairie restoration and I'm trying to squeeze native grasses anywhere I can on a property.
Yeah. So,
I love it. There, you'd be hard pressed to find any ecosystem type that is more, you know, species rich than a grassland. You can drive past these grasslands in the Great Plains and they don't look like much, but if you ever get out of your vehicle and get on your hands and knees and start identifying how many different plant species are out there, how many different types of grasshoppers you flush out of there, or the songbirds that like early successional habitat, this brushy, it is so incredibly important. I can't stress it enough. Being able to manage early successional habitat for all wildlife is so crucial. And that's why it breaks my heart when I look at areas like the Northeast right now. There's a lot of initiatives going on in the Northeast where they're incentivizing landowners to take every open area they have on their property and plant trees on it.
Yeah.
So whether it's carbon sequestering credits or just reforestation programs or whatever they're going under, it blows my mind that the same regions that are struggling with songbird diversity and losing their song, like golden wing warblers, are promoting landowners to go in and effectively erase all of our open spaces on the landscape.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. Because you look at a species like the golden wing warbler, who is associated with young forest patch habitat, and you're completely getting rid of all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of discussions going on our agencies doing things to hurt or help our resources, this, that, or the other. At the end of the day, you know, it's going to boil down to private landowners taking this seriously and pulling our weight.
Yeah.
We're going to be the ones that can save these resources. We're going to be the ones that, you know, like it or not, the people, the public land hunting diehards, God bless them. I love them. I like hunting public land too. But they have to acknowledge that a lot of the resources, even the animals that they're getting shot opportunities at, had spent some amount of time on private ground.
Absolutely.
Where like you look at something like turkeys, where like there's no way these state agencies are going to be able to hire in enough trappers to come in and get, you know, the nest predators under control.
Right.
But a coalition of landowners can start to do that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's always like habitat is... We get a lot more freedoms on the private side of things. There's a lot less red tape to go through.
Yeah.
And the opportunities are just boundless. You know, you can take a lot of the things that I'm talking about disturbance, about seral stages, about different plant communities. You can apply those to public land hunting and you're going to be able to find better spots much quicker. You know, it's understanding the ecology of these creatures and what they need is going to make you a more efficient outdoorsman.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard people say before, when you want to really get on good wildlife, you either have to build it on private land or you got to go find it on public land. Right. And I think that's exactly what you're mentioning here. And I think that's kind of the way conservation has always been. It's always been the hunters who have taken the initiative to save the animal. And I think that comes right in with any private land ownership. So, all right, let's imagine we've got a private landowner listening who's just been fired up by what you said. And they're like, dang it, I need to get out there. They have not lifted a finger towards habitat management and it's July. Can they do anything this time of year?
Yeah.
Cool. What can they do?
So this is actually... This is a great time to be out killing invasives. It's a miserable time of year to be out killing invasives, but it's a good time to do it. A lot of them have recently flowered, so if you can get out there and terminate them before it goes to seed, you'll avoid one generation of them. A lot of species, like Tree of Heaven around here, the beans are just starting to show up. They're easy to identify this time of year. We're starting to get later in the year where they're starting to look more like sumac or whatever, but it's a great time to treat invasives. A lot of people... We'll jump right into invasives work in late spring when everything's starting to leaf out. It's kind of this weird spot where they're not quite ready to put food plots in the ground, but they want to do something. So they'll go start cutting down invasives, but they don't get a good response because all that sap is flowing up and it doesn't get a kill in the root system. So I like treating invasive waiting a little bit. Summertime's a good time to do that. Another good thing to be doing this time of year is once you get towards the end of July, into August, growing season burns. So again, we're talking about disturbance and we're talking about when you're applying that disturbance, whether that's how often you apply it or the time of year you apply it. When you apply the disturbance matters.
Yeah.
So if you're, so let's take a grassland, for example. I got a lot of my food plots. Like I was talking earlier, people, my clients give me a hard time for being so obsessed with grasslands. I say they give me a hard time because oftentimes I'll recommend taking stuff out of food plot and putting it into native grasses. And it's a hard concept for people to juggle with. Yeah. But let's say we're managing a grassland, okay? And I want more wildflowers. I want more food for deer. So deer aren't really going to eat grasses. They eat the forbs and wildflowers that are growing up in and amongst the grasses. If you burn in the dormant season, so let's say you go in December and burn, it's going to promote your grasses, okay? So you're going to go from grasses to more grasses, all right? Whereas if you wait and you burn this time of year, you can burn in end of July, middle of August, when you get a nice dry spell and you get a day with some high humidity, get in there and burn it, that's actually going to terminate those grasses. So, I mean, it's the same thing we were talking about earlier with those plants going to seed and getting them cut. Well, those grasses are going to flower in late summer, and you can get them on the ground and burn them. You're in good shape. You're going to terminate a lot of what happens if you burn in the, it's the same thing. Like you can talk about grasses or talk about trees. When you apply a fire, you're trying to send that cambium layer with sending, you're sending nutrients up. If all of their nutrients is underground in their root system, like it is during the dormant season, you're not going to get as good of a kill. Whereas if you can apply that fire during the growing season while all the nutrition is up in the plant and the top of the plant itself, that's actually going to terminate those grasses. So that's when you get a lot more of those annuals popping up. That's what the deer are eating. That's your ragweed. That's your goldenrod. That's your trefoil. You know, that's the stuff that's going to start popping up. So if you can get a good burn in at the end of July, that grassland that was, say, predominantly Indian grass or big blue stem, all of a sudden, if you get a burn in mid-July, late July, you're looking at an awesome food plot come hunting season, because you're going to get a flush of ragweed, goldenrod, all of these plants that are drought tolerant. That's the thing you got to remember. You can't plant your fall food plots until you got rain, right?
Yeah.
All of these things have evolved to grow no matter what. Yeah. You know, they're native to these areas, so they don't need much water to take off.
Yeah.
So you might get a couple brief showers, but that'll be enough to get that thing started.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you got something that is very much acting much like a food plot that you didn't have to plant, that you got established a month and a half before anyone else started working on their fall food plots.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great practice you can do this time of year. And I really don't think landowners utilize it or not. People always associate, or I don't want to say always, but most of the time when I talk about, you know, prescribed fire, everyone assumes the winter time, the dormant season burn. But like the property I just got done working on in Nebraska, I was talking to the Quail Forever guy out in southern Nebraska where my client was located. And I was trying to put together a burn plan for my client. And I was asking about, you know, what are the best times of year to get fire on the ground? You want to do this? The main thing I was concerned, he's got a bunch of cedar piles of cedar trees I had him removing. But he was telling me they don't do dormant season burns for the most part. And I started asking why. And humidity out there on the Great Plains, they just don't have high enough humidity. It's too dry in the wintertime. But he was like, we have a fantastic response and we have a much bigger burn window when you start talking about these growing season fires. That's when we have our humidity during the growing season. So again, it's a cultural thing where you're from. You know, down in the South, they do growing season burns in the Southeast. They do it all the time. They don't think twice. In the Northeast, I mean, they're just starting to do dormant season burns. You know, it's definitely a cultural thing based on where you're at in the country. But yeah, growing season fires, like I said, treating invasives. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. trail work. A lot of people don't pay attention to trail work, getting deer stands and stuff. Now's a great time of year to get that stuff done. Last thing you want is the week before deer season where you're going to hang stands and you have to run the chainsaw and the leaf blower and you got the rake and get all that stuff done this time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. So doing stuff this time of year, do you get poison ivy?
Mm-hmm.
So what are
some I get poison ivy. How do I used you to never get it.
Yeah. Okay.
So when I was in high school and growing up, I used to never get poison ivy. When I got into college, I started getting it mildly at the beginning of my college career. Towards the end of it, I couldn't look at poison ivy without getting an extreme rash. Here, the last couple of years, my tolerance, I don't know if my tolerance has gone up or my awareness has gone up or what's going on. I don't really get it as bad anymore. I'm always wearing long sleeves for the most part. I've switched to long, like a lot of the stuff I wear, like the bamboo shirts, like the free fly stuff.
Yeah.
It might be really hot and you might not want to wear long sleeves, but between the ticks and the poison ivy and actually those long sleeve shirts, when you're out in the summertime, when you start sweating, they'll cool you down pretty quick. So yeah, I do get poison ivy. I do get ticks. I've been running a lot of permethrin here lately. I've been having pretty good results with that stuff. But
yeah, because I wanted to ask, because so like last deer season, it was early enough in the season. I wanted to climb this particular tree and it was covered in poison ivy. And I was just like, well, I'm going to do it anyway. So I killed the poison ivy at the bottom of the tree, you know, just cut through it. But obviously that's not working fast enough because I'm going to get in it today. And I got it pretty bad. And I every year get it pretty decent when I'm prepping tree stands because I just can't avoid it. And I'm not the type of person that's going to stay out of a tree just because it has some poison ivy in it. I'm going to get up there and take care of that. But it's getting to where every time I get it, it gets worse. And I'm starting to get a little worried about it. So wearing long sleeves, I think, makes a lot of sense. And then I also get chiggers really just incredibly every summer when I'm doing stuff like this. You got any secret tricks you use for those kind of things? Like what's your gear when you're going up in the summer to do this kind of stuff?
So typically I'm wearing light colored pants. So you can see ticks crawling up them. That's important. A lot of the pants, like durable, I use a lot of briar pants. They're hot. They're kind of miserable to wear in the summertime, but the stuff I'm working in, I'd rather be hot and walk through briars than get caught up in the briars. So light colored briar pants, I'm typically tucking my socks in. I haven't done it, but I've been with people that run duct tape backwards around their shins to pick up bugs. If I keep getting ticks at the same rate, maybe I'll try it someday. Like I said, permethrin, I'm using that. And then the other thing is I talk about long sleeves and longer pants. We have a lot of stinging nettle on my farm.
Ooh.
So the baggier your pants are, the better you are walking through that stuff. It's kind of counterintuitive, but the baggier your pants are, the easier to get through that kind of nasty stuff.
Yeah, keeps it off your leg, right?
And water. I always bring way more water than I ever need.
Yeah.
My thought is most people are probably going to get dehydrated before they have a chainsaw injury. Always have your PPE with you. I'm trying to think of any other disclaimers I should throw out there.
No, that's good. I like it. Because, I mean, this, like, summertime habitat work. Yeah, summertime habitat work is no joke. And I've done a lot of it. In fact, last year, I had a real reckoning. The power company came through and cleared the right-of-way on a power line that happened to be on my grandpa's farm. And it was a spot, like a little sort of hidey hole spot I wanted to put a food plot. And I was like, this is great. Well, they mulched up a few trees and mulched the whole thing. And I was like, all I got to do is get in there with a rake, rake that out of the way, broadcast some seed, boom, free food plot that's never seen sunlight before. This is going to be awesome. Well, 10 minutes into raking this stuff out, I realized it's not as awesome as I hoped it would be because my heart rate is just going nuts, you know, because if you don't go out and just try to rake like several pounds of mulch, you don't really understand. Yeah, you don't understand what that's going to really be like. And I had one day to do it, and it was still. There wasn't any breeze. And I would rake up that dust and just breathe it in. And it was just like something I wish I would have done a little more piecemeal, not tried to just get out in one day and do everything I had to do. But I wish I would have just done like half of it today, half of it tomorrow, and then been done. But
yeah, I mean, you gotta pace yourself. And oftentimes doing habitat work this time of year, there's always dew on the ground in the morning on my farm. I'm right on the Cumberland River. It's a very cold water river. It doesn't get above 55 degrees where I'm at. And so there's constantly fog coming in the morning, and it gets all of my food plots wet, and I can't spray until later in the day. Same thing if I'm spot spraying for Sericea lespidisa and I'm walking through my prairies looking for it. You get covered in dew. You're going to be wet. You're going to be miserable. So figuring out things you can do while I'm waiting on the dew to dry. Maybe I'm going to go do, cut stump treatment on bush honeysuckle until the field's dry, until I can go do that. You know, don't wear yourself out. Be smart about what you're doing out there. Have a game plan together.
Yeah.
And I do my best when I'm driving around in the summertime, even if I'm just going for a ride and I'm not, you know, don't have plans on doing it, I'll leave a bottle of herbicide and a hatchet in my side by side.
Yeah.
You know, I want to have the ability where if I see something, like the other day I was on my farm, I found a thicket of Tree of Heaven that I had marked it at one point 2 years ago. I guess I had stumbled across it when I was shed hunting and then I forgot about it.
Ah.
Well, the other day I was out on my farm and I found it, and it was way worse than I had thought. Like It was just like a forest of Tree of Heaven. Mm. Well, I marked that in my phone, and you know what? Next time I have a morning where I'm waiting on the dew to dry off, guess where I'm going?
Yeah.
Treat the tree. So keep a notepad, you know, either in your side by side, on your phone, start taking notes, stay organized. And then just don't overexert yourself and take pictures. You know, you want before and after. It's always good to have something to reference when you go back to these locations. Take notes. I think too many people go in here, well, what time of year did you open up the canopy? I can't remember if I did that did it in April or if I did it in July. Well, that kind of stuff's important when you're reflecting on the results.
Yeah.
So unless you're keeping track of that kind of stuff, you're going to have a harder time referencing the success or the failures of your projects.
Right. That makes a ton of sense, man. You gotta keep notes. I imagine your phone's just full of pictures of just outside, just everything.
You should see my Onyx, man. It's like a gumball machine with all the pins.
Oh yeah, man. I believe it. Yeah. That's the way mine is. I have, like, in the past I've done color coding systems, and then as time has gone on, I've changed what they are. Like, not a lot of people probably noticed, but like a year or two ago, Onyx had green become an available color, which I was super excited about, because like it makes a lot of sense to rate your hunting spots red, yellow, or green, right? Just kind of like traffic light rules.
Yep.
And so I finally got that. So now I'm like, okay, that's a green pen. So that's recent. It's just, it all makes
sense. So when I started doing these, writing management plans, I've always done them on X, just because most people have X and it's easy for me to send it to them.
Yeah.
Here recently, I started doing it on Google Earth because X, and I brought this up to them. I emailed them. I called them. I brought it up a couple of times. Squeaky wheel trying to get some change.
Yeah, man.
So if they're listening, hey, we need more color options on X.
Yeah.
That's a big issue I run into, especially when I'm writing a management plan for a 1,000-acre farm. If there's only 8 color options, I'm kind of hamstrung as far as, you know, color coordinating everything. So
yeah,
I'm actually switched over to Google Earth last year to start doing this kind of thing, 'cause I have more freedom as far as, color schemes and stuff like that goes. And the interface is a little nicer, but there's no taupe lines on Google Earth.
Right. So. Yeah. That's the real problem. I know that when I'm doing e-scouting for anything, I'm always jumping back and forth between 3 or 4 different mapping apps. And
yeah, it's crazy.
I just act like a mad scientist, man. But that's where stuff gets fun, right? Is when you really can get into all this stuff. So we've discussed nesting, brooding, habitat, what that looks like, how you want to try and get that.
Include one thing about brooding cover?
Please do.
Just to try to simplify it for people. A lot of people don't realize how fragile those little turkey poults are. So their legs are like toothpicks. They're not very strong. They're not real powerful. You know, they got 3-4 weeks until they can kind of scutter up into a bush or whatever. They need bare ground. They can't walk through your front lawn.
Wow.
You know, think about that. They'd have a hard time crossing the grass in your front lawn. You've seen turkey poults. They'll trip over their own feet and fall. They need bare ground. They need disturbance. If you want, I mean, you can say the same thing about quail management. Mm. If you're managing strictly for turkeys, you should try your best to get fire on the ground every year. And if you can't get fire on the ground, I'm well aware there's many circumstances, many states, many areas. It's just not realistic to burn. That doesn't mean you can't have bare ground exposed. Get out there and spray some with the herbicide. Do some dormant season disking. You know, that's a great alternative to fire. If you can go into these native grasses and turn the soil over in the wintertime, boom, you're terminating those grasses. You're stimulating your broadleafs like your ragweed, and you're exposing bare mineral ground that those turkey poults need in order to navigate. So that's a long-winded way of saying, just think about the critter that you're managing for.
Yeah.
You know, it's a turkey poult. It's a tiny little thing that needs bare ground to navigate, and it needs bugs. Set that little guy or gal up in the best possible situation where they can navigate and find the resources they need to live.
Yeah, I like it, man. That makes a lot of sense. You got to think about how they can't walk anywhere. And, you know, that's something I would have never thought about.
Get on your belly. I'm not even kidding. Lay on your belly and look around. And if you can't imagine a turkey poult being able to navigate through there, a turkey poult probably can't navigate through there. Mm. Like, it sounds silly, but
that's what it means. That's what it is. Yeah. I think that we always struggle to think in terms of the animal's experience, because we always are putting our own ideas over something. Like, anybody who's out here hunting is generally a fully functioning adult. And you just don't think about how are these things going to survive when they're bare. You just think about why they hate you and want to try and ruin your life.
Yeah.
That's how you always think about it. Right. So a lot of people want to talk about predators, and I want to talk about predators because that's fun. That's more active. And as humans, historically, we are extremely selfish when it comes to hunting. We do not want hunting competition. I think this is why people always want to be like, it's predators, it's predators, it's predators, when that's not always the case, right? Or is that always the case? What's your take?
I'm probably the last person you want to talk to about predators. Here's kind of my viewpoint on predators. They have a place on the landscape. I'm not anti-predator hunting. I'm not anti-trapping. I recommend trapping. I recommend, you know, taking care of what you need to take care of on your property. The trap I don't like my guys falling into or gals falling into is fooling themselves into thinking shooting a coyote in February is going to save their turkey. Or shooting a random, you know, coyote from your deer stand is going to save all your deer fawns. It's just not how it works. So when talking about, and we can just narrow down and talk about turkey management with predators. So if you want to go that route, I think the most important thing is you gotta make a distinction when talking about these predators. So you have nest predators, and then you have turkey predators. And those are two very different things. Sometimes, you know, the turkey predators will certainly consume a nest. So a turkey predator, we're talking about bobcats. We're talking about owls. We're talking about hawks. We're talking about coyotes, you know, foxes. All of these mesopredators, medium-sized predators, and avian predators that can take out an owl, you can worry about those. So that's your turkey predators. Next, you got to talk about the nest predators. So what comes to mind when you're thinking nest predator? I'll quiz you.
Okay. I'm thinking raccoons. I'm thinking possums. I'm thinking house cats, snakes, maybe. I don't know if cats will eat an egg, but
believe it or not, black rat snakes are actually top of the list. As far as consuming eggs. Yep. They'll watch that hen lay on the nest. She'll leave. They'll go down. They'll eat an egg or two. They'll climb back up. She'll come back, she'll leave, and come down, do it again until that thing's gone. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, we got nest predators, we got turkey predators. If you want to protect your birds, And based off of the, you know, the PhD biologists I've talked to and had this conversation with, because they're coming from the standpoint here, I'll set the whole stage. So they're coming from the standpoint of, we were talking about supplemental feed and how it affects turkey. So what we were looking at was a deer station with protein in it. And my questions were regarding, how is this extra feed affecting the turkey population? And I wasn't talking about, okay, the hens can come here and eat these protein pellets. I was talking about, we have all this extra food out here on the ground. We have way more raccoons that are being fed. We have way more possums. We got way more of these predators, that these nest predators that'll consume this extra protein on the ground that wouldn't be there if we weren't out putting it out from deer. Okay. The biologist I was talking to, he's a PhD. Most of his research was surrounding turkeys and, you know, turkey recruitment. My point of view was, there wasn't a situation in my head where I could see how inflating the raccoon population and armadillos and possums. I just couldn't comprehend how inflating, you know, unnaturally, artificially inflating those populations wouldn't have a negative impact on turkey nests.
Yeah.
And I started pressing him on this because he was adamant, no, like it doesn't have, it's the turkey predator. So here's the thing. Here's why I made that distinction early on. Again, this is his claim. which he's done way more research than I have. So take it with a grain of salt. A hen turkey is a much more formidable, you know, defender of her nest than we like to give her credit for. So I might be falling into that category. Because when I'm looking at it, I'm thinking a big tom raccoon's going to walk up and either, he might not kill her, but he's going to bully her off that nest and he's going to get those eggs. Researcher tells me that's not the case. His point is, if you focus your trapping on the turkey predators, so if you focus on bobcat trapping, if you focus on coyote hunting, if you focus on targeting those critters that which you're allowed to do, you know, you can't do anything about owls, you can't do anything about hawks, but you can target coyotes, you can target bobcats. When you start addressing that situation, and again, I'm not going to get into the whole song and dance about how those predators use the landscape and in home ranges and transient and this, that, or the other, but in the most simplest form, if you can decrease the amount of predators, turkey predators on the landscape while those birds are on their nest. So it has to be very specific when you're going in and doing your trapping. But if you're doing that trapping and you're targeting them right when those turkeys are building their nests and they're breeding and they're sitting on those nests, yes, it doesn't, or I get back to my guy, it doesn't matter that you have more raccoons on the landscape due to baiting, because those hens are going to have a good time protecting their nests. Okay. So it's a very long-winded way of trying to bring a little clarity to a very complex issue. Yes, trapping does help. But you do have to understand what you're trapping. I think most important would be trapping those larger predators that are going to target your hens. If you can keep those hens on the landscape, they'll do a better job at protecting the nest from the nest predators. Wow. You follow?
Yeah, I totally follow. It's different than what I would have thought. So it's very
different than what I thought 6 months ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Because so you'd think I'm that still wrapping my head around. You got to stop them from eating the eggs. But you're saying the hen will take care of that if you can take care of the hen, kind of a deal.
And that's what all this, that's the linchpin that this is all hanging on, that I'm really hoping is true. You know, like it's a hard thing. I've seen turkeys jump off of her nest when I'm 200 yards away. So to me, it's like, I have a hard time thinking that a hen turkey is going to fight a tom raccoon. But again, he's done the research. This is what he's saying. In targeting those nest predators, you know, you're not going to go out there and you're not going to catch every black rat snake on the landscape.
Right.
But if you get a ripping hot fire going through there during the summertime,
might catch them.
You might burn up a couple rat snakes. You might burn up some of those ticks out there. That's another, this kind of unrelated topic, but prescribed fires. A lot of people have hesitation on burning during nesting season, and all the data out there points to you might ruin a nest or two. It might happen. but the net gain is going to far exceed what you lost off of that one nest or two nests that burn up. So something to keep in mind.
I've heard before that if you have good habitat, the predators are not as much of an issue, but if you don't have good habitat, that's when the predators can come in and have a heyday, because that hen doesn't have a good spot to lay her nest, or those poults don't have the place that they need to be to escape the predation, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, one of the things I always talk about is, like, edge feathering. Let's take it. You got a 100-acre farm. There's 10-acre field in the middle of it. And so it's mature woodlot all around and then one opening in the middle. An edge feather project is thinning those trees around the perimeter of that field, right? That's your nesting habitat. In that situation, that would be the best nesting cover. It would be that thin strip around the outside of that field, right? It would be very easy for a raccoon or for a coyote or a bobcat to just stay in that little 10-yard swath and be able to sniff out every single nest along the perimeter of that trail. Again, this goes back to the shape of the management techniques that you're using. And so if you're only doing an edge feather project and you're counting on that to save all your turkey nests, it's not going to work. You're going to have to also follow that up with maybe a patch cut, maybe an open season burn, maybe a crop tree release project. You want to give that turkey options on where she can put her nest so she's not confined to that area. So like you were saying, you're exactly right. You want to make it as difficult on those predators as possible. It's another thing where, like, yes, if you have a soybean field, a buffer strip of native grasses around it is better than no buffer strip around it. But what would be better than a buffer strip around the perimeter would be maybe a whole section on one side of that field of native grasses so that it's not as easy for a predator to sniff out the nests that are in there. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Depth of cover, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's really important to remember, because I think it's just, it gets so easy to think the wrong way about how these predators work. And obviously the way we're doing it is not fixing anything right now, or else we wouldn't be having, like, for instance, in Missouri, a pretty good decline in turkey numbers, right? If everything was going great, we wouldn't have these questions. So I think it's really important when we hear new information to take it in, because obviously what we have been doing hasn't been working, right? We've had the boom time of incredible turkey numbers, and now they're waning. Well, there's a reason for that, right? And so I think that this answers a lot of those questions. If we're thinking the wrong way about habitat management, if we're thinking the wrong way about predator management, then we're putting in a lot of effort and not seeing a lot of results.
Yeah. I mean, like go back to what I was saying earlier. Everyone wants to know what seed can I plant that's going to fix this problem?
Yeah.
Fire. There's no answer to that question. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. I think that makes a lot of sense. So when you come into a new place and you're trying to sort of identify its shortcomings, what's kind of your step process? Like, number one thing that you're looking for on a new property to make sure they have, or does it change with every property?
Well, the most important thing for me is figuring out what the landowner's objectives are. So after we sit down, we have that conversation, you know, whether they have me there, you know, yeah, I like deer hunting. It'd be nice to have some bigger deer, but I really, you know, retirement, I'd like timber value. Okay. I can work with that, you know?
Yeah.
Or the other person, I don't care what we do. I just want the biggest deer possible or I want more turkeys or whatever. So understanding their objectives, understanding how much time and resources they have available to put into carrying this out, that's always most important. I'm never going to write a management plan for somebody that isn't feasible. Yeah. You know, like, there's no point in that. So right. I take it very seriously in working with the landowner on figuring out, you know, what the capabilities are. So after I figured that out, when we're on a property, I then put that lens in front of my face and I'm looking at everything through that lens. So if we're targeting turkey, you know, I'm going to be paying attention to where's the nesting cover on this property. Where are the roosting trees? I'm going to be asking that landowner historical observations. You know, where are you seeing the turkeys roosting? Where have you jumped them off a nest? So I'm going to walk around and I'm going to piecemeal it together that way. Now, there's a lot you can do from home before you even step side on a property. So one of the things I like doing is if I'm getting ready to go, like the property in Nebraska, I was just at, I'll pull that property up. And we were talking about mapping softwares earlier. One of the things I do like about Google Earth is you can hop backwards. They have a time hop feature where I can jump back, and it's not always the best, you know, clarity on the images, but I can tell when there's like a, when there was a recent timber harvest. I can tell, okay, yeah. I knew those trees were younger, but I didn't realize they were cut in 2007. And by jumping back on that timeline, I can figure out one that was cut. Or, oh, they used to have cows out here. That's another thing. I'm walking around, I see a lot of, you know, honey locusts or cherry. Okay, this is probably cattle pasture back here. So I'm taking notes like that. And as we're going, like, one of the things, turkeys aren't nearly as, they don't leave the amount of sign that a deer leaves.
Yeah.
So when you're walking a property and you're trying to manage it for turkeys, a lot of it has to be observational and versus like what I'm seeing, because they're not going to leave a browse line. They're, you know, they are leaving scat on the ground, but their scat doesn't stick around as long as a whitetail's does.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little harder to pick up on how those animals are utilizing the landscape. So that's one of the things where if you can, you know, talk to the landowner about moving some trail cameras around, getting better pictures, maybe using time-lapse features on some of those cameras. But when I'm out walking the property, it's, you know, invasives are a big one for me. We talked about that earlier. I put a lot more emphasis on, you know, managing our native plant communities than I think a lot of other habitat managers do. I think that is our, not only our response, it's our duty. Yeah. It is our obligation. If you own that piece of property, to take care of it and try to make it the way it should be. So walking around looking for invasives, looking for any sort of erosion issues. And then the big thing is, what does this property look like compared to the surrounding properties? So again, something you can do before you even get out there is just zoom out, get to 30,000 feet, start looking at what the neighbors do. Even if you're managing 400 acres, that's still smaller than the average white-tailed deer's home range. So you have to understand that you're never going to completely occupy those animals' living arrangements. You know, they're going to, it's a give and take with the neighbors. The name of the game is being able to, provide anything that deer might need on your property, so that he's not tempted or he doesn't have to go elsewhere to find that feed resource, find this area. I mean, in its simplest form, it would be like, okay, we're back out in Iowa. I'm on a 100-acre farm in Iowa. I'm probably not going to tell that landowner he needs to plant soybeans.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Like,
nothing is going to make your soybeans more delicious than your neighbor's soybeans. Right. Now, if you have a sharecropper in there who's planting soy, I'm not going to say you don't plant soybeans, but your soybeans aren't any more special than your neighbor's soybeans. So if you look at it that way and you think, okay, all the neighbors are coming in, combines are coming in the fall, are getting rid of all that stuff, there's a little spent grain on the ground, what can I do to occupy, to have deer occupy my property after all the neighbors pick theirs? Well, maybe you start with not planting those soybeans. Maybe you start with planting a nice diverse fall blend that's, you know, starting to really take off in the fall when those beans are starting to yellow.
Yeah.
Get those deer conditioned to start going somewhere else for their food source, where they're going to get their peas or their wheat or whatever they're going after. Just being cognizant of what those animals need, when they're going to use it, and how what you can provide compares to what's around you.
Yeah.
I think a streamlined way of what I do. So
I said it
depends on what the landowner is trying to accomplish on their property. You know, some landowners are very adamant they want to get enrolled in NRCS programs or EQIP programs, and by all means, I love getting my landowners signed up in those NRCS programs. You know, it's another layer of accountability that I have, that the landowner is now under contract to get this stuff done.
Yeah,
I like that aspect of it. But not all landowners want to go that route. Some other landowners, you know, I might just need to call them every now and then and remind them, hey, did you get that burn in this spring, this Saturday?
Yeah.
It's so, I mean, every property is different, but the lowest hole in the bucket is always going to be dictated on what the landowner's management objectives are.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. So let's get one more thing here. So, from a turkey hunting perspective, what kind of habitat are you looking for? Like, if you were going to take some of your habitat knowledge and apply it to a turkey season hunt, what are you going to be looking for? And imagine that the people you're talking to might not know half as much, even a quarter as much about plant species as you do. What would you be looking for?
So I'd be looking for nesting type cover. Mm-hmm. Like I said, shrubby, thick, same stuff you would expect the deer to be bedded down in. Nesting type cover adjacent to an area with good visibility. They are such visual creatures that, you know, you get a spring that's like, I got the farm next to my farm is a bunch of hay pastures going up this holler. Mm-hmm. And depending on the year, depending on how much rain we get in the spring, we either have almost every turkey in the county wants to be out displaying in those hay pastures, or if those hay pastures are a little too tall, you won't see a bird out there. Yeah. They don't want to be out there. It's too dangerous for them to be out there. And all that had to do is a difference in how much rain they got in the spring. You know, it's the same species growing out there. So, you know, I would say an area with good visibility adjacent to nesting cover.
I like it. Very, very succinct. I really appreciate that, man. Well, man, I can't thank you enough for being on the podcast today. Tell people where they can find you, how they can hire you, like what you kind of do. I mean, like they know what you do, but tell them a little bit more about how to get in touch with you.
Yeah, so my company is Whetstone Habitat, the Whetstone. You can follow all of my YouTube, Instagrams at Whetstone Habitat, website, whetstonehabitat.com. Again, that's Whetstone. You can contact me, fill out if you're interested, if you're a property owner and you got some land, I have a contact us page, fill out that form. Let me know where your farm is. Tell me a little bit about it. Tell me you heard me on the podcast, and I'd love to start from there. I always start with like an onboarding phone call, try to get some questions answered, tell the landowner a little bit about myself and kind of my management practices. Again, one of the things I think kind of sets me apart is I'm very into the whole holistic approach. I want all these moving parts to be working together. So, by all means, if anybody's interested, feel free to reach out.
Sweet. I appreciate it, man. And thank you guys for listening. I really appreciate that. You can find me as well on social media. I'm on Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. There we go. That's all three of them. And I also have an email page. It's howtohuntturkey@gmail.com. Leave me a 5-star review if you can. But anyways, thank you guys so much for listening, and take somebody hunting with you.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.